World Record Lightning Mega Flash. Sounds like a pretty bright place to kick off a new show. I'm Carl Azus. It's good to see you. According to a spokesman from the World Meteorological Organization, a mega flash is a really, really big lightning flash. The official definition is any horizontal lightning bolt that travels more than 62 miles. But the record-breaking mega flash that the WMO just announced was a little bit bigger. This bolt covered a distance of roughly 477 miles, and it struck across a path from Texas to Louisiana on April 9th, 2020. How do scientists know? How do they measure this stuff? A lot of it's done using Lightning Mapping Array Networks, a group of antennas, receivers, and computers that record lightning. These networks are based from the ground, though. They have limitations when it comes to mega flashes. So what researchers have been doing is using satellites to record and measure lightning events, and that's given them a new tool that collects more data about them. This led to the recent discovery of another record, one that was set in South America. On October 31st, 2018, a single mega flash lasted just over 17.1 seconds. That was the longest mega flash ever recorded. It lit up the skies over Uruguay and northern Paraguay, and it probably scared the daylights out of anyone who noticed a 17-second lightning bolt. Geostation lightning mapper technology on satellites is relatively new, so scientists think that bigger and brighter mega flashes will be observed in the future. They say one big takeaway from this is that it shows people just how far lightning can reach, and that can encourage folks to stay safe and take shelter as severe weather season approaches in the spring. The crash of an American fighter jet in the South China Sea is another complication in an ongoing international dispute over these waters. Located between Vietnam and the Philippines, the South China Sea is one of the busiest shipping routes on the planet. China says it controls this body of water, and since 2014, it's been building artificial islands here to support its claims. But other nations in the region and several beyond it, including the United States, say China doesn't control these waters, and the U.S. regularly sails warships there to support claims that these are international waters.
The final approach of an F-35C stealth fighter jet, seconds before it crash lands into the flight deck of a U.S. aircraft carrier. Images circulated on social media, confirmed by the U.S. Navy, show the plane moments later in the ocean, canopy open after its pilot escaped. The cause of the crash, which injured the pilot and six sailors, still under investigation. The Navy now has the difficult task of recovering the wreckage of a $100 million jet from the bottom of the ocean to make sure, defense experts say, that its classified technology doesn't fall into the wrong hands.
The Chinese have a long history of being able to borrow something from overseas and reverse engineer it. So that this would certainly be a gold mine as far as that goes.
The crash occurred here in the South China Sea, a heavily trafficked body of water that Beijing claims almost all for itself. And this is where two American aircraft carriers are currently operating, accompanied by more than 100 warplanes and at least 10 other warships, an unmistakable demonstration of U.S. naval power to both allies and rivals in Asia.
That is a powerful reminder that the Indo-Pacific is of central strategic importance to the Biden administration. It's about signaling to other competitors in the region, most notably China, that the United States' credibility should not be taken lightly.
The Chinese Foreign Ministry says it's not interested in the crashed plane. A spokesman urged the U.S. to contribute more to regional peace rather than flexing force at every turn. But Chinese state media did some gloating, saying the crash exposed U.S. exhaustion at containing China. Experts predict it will take several weeks for the U.S. Navy to recover this expensive wreck from the bottom of the sea. Ivan Watson, CNN, Hong Kong.
10-second trivia. Which of these sports made its Olympic debut in the 1920 Summer Games? Ice hockey, cycling, curling, or fencing? Ice hockey was first played in the 1920 Summer Games and moved to the first Winter Olympics in 1924. Women's ice hockey was added to the Olympics in 1998, and at every tournament since then, the gold medal has gone to either Canada or the United States. After an American victory in 98, Canada won four Olympics in a row from 2002 to 2014, but the U.S. is the defending champion from the 2018 games in South Korea. One of the players on America's current Olympic team was born just across the St. Mary's River from Canada. Hockey is in her blood.
It's made me who I am today, playing with the guys and having to be tough and not let things get to you. I have to always be proving people wrong because people don't think you're tough enough to play with the boys or good enough to play with the boys until they really see it.
She does have a chip. She's always had, even in boys hockey, she had a little edge to her. She stood up for herself. And biggest challenge is just trying to find a place for her to change a lot of these rinks. No one had women's locker rooms. She was in closets.
When you're younger, especially back in the day, I would look at players and I would think, I want to be in the NHL. But there wasn't the NHL for girls like me, especially at the time. And I was sitting there, I was like, well, what else can I do? And then all of a sudden you see these amazing U.S. hockey players on the Olympic stage doing their thing. And I'm like, yeah, that's my dream. That's the highest you can go in hockey. And that's the team I want to be on. My dad was a hockey coach growing up. My mom wanted me to be in figure skates. I hated them. So I basically forced my way out of the figure skates and into hockey skates because I just wanted to be like my dad and like his players.
She was generally interested in everything from the equipment to how the guys dressed, what sticks they used, and all the little things they would do with pucks on the ice. And so it was great to have her around.
For him, it was all about having fun. He was never trying to make me the best hockey player in the world. I think he just knew I loved it and wanted me to be exposed to it and built the ice rink so I could have fun with my friends. And I think that's where a lot of my skill and my talent really comes from, is just all those years having fun in the backyard. I've definitely had an unconventional journey to get to this team. Growing up as an Indigenous person, it wasn't really that rare to see other hockey players playing who had Indigenous roots. And then I got to college, and I think that's where it really clicked for me that you're different than the rest of the people.
It's a challenge for, I know, for a lot of Indigenous kids to get off the reserve or off the band and move away and fit in. But, you know, Abby obviously was real lucky that she grew up with a lot of kids like that in her town.
I want to help to diversify hockey as a sport. Making the sport more diverse is just trying to make it more accessible, first of all, but also just gaining more visibility that you can make it. I think looking at this roster as a young kid, you didn't see anybody who wasn't a white hockey player. For me, that goes a long way, seeing somebody like you doing it, being at the top of the game and knowing that you can make it that far and that hockey is a sport that includes you. If one little girl says, I want to play hockey because she's playing hockey, I think that would mean the world to me. Just changing one person's trajectory and letting them know that there is a place for them in hockey and letting hockey do its thing, because hockey really is one of the greatest things that's ever happened to me.
The other night I was watching something and I kind of had tears in my eyes just thinking about it a little bit. I'd have an Olympian daughter, you know, and now she's going to go to the Olympics and try to win a gold medal. And she wrote a letter to herself in grade six that she was going to play at Wisconsin. She was going to play in the Olympic team. And, you know, the only thing she hasn't done yet is get the Mustang, she said in the letter she's getting. So, I mean, she's a focused kid.
It's just really special to be able to represent your country on truly the biggest stage there is.
This isn't a one-time thing for Abby. I think she wants to play now, and she wants to play in 4 years. I think Abby wants to play for a long time. She loves it.
I wouldn't want to play hockey unless it was the most fun thing in the world, and it really is for me.
As of yesterday afternoon, the cheapest seats you could buy for Super Bowl 56 were selling for $7,000 each. The average price was around $10,000 or more, and the cost could go even higher in the coming days. That makes this the most expensive Super Bowl ever for tickets. The Cincinnati Bengals have never won a championship. The city of Los Angeles, California hasn't hosted a Super Bowl in 30 years, and it's a huge metropolitan area where prices are expensive anyway. So those are all factors in ticket prices. So the prices are super. It's almost unbelievable for some fans in the stands. It's almost unachievable, and their bankers may block them, saying it's out of bounds for them to draw down accounts just to see some touchdowns. But if you've received a raise and can foot the bill for football, hike your budget, and you make the call. I'm Carl Azus. Want to give a shout out to all the homeschoolers watching today. We know you represent a growing part of our audience, and we're thankful for you and everyone viewing CNN.